Hadi bakalım.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Human Reaction Podcast. I'm David Rand. For those who you might be seeing this from outside of our normal audience, I'm a political consultant, communicator, and I am the CEO and president of a forthcoming land liberty movement, and of course the host at Human Reaction Podcast. Today I have with me Jose Nino. Jose, could you introduce yourself to everybody?
Yeah, I'm the deputy editor at Headline USA and just a general journalist that covers geopolitics and other issues from like a populist perspective on numerous websites. I've got my own Substack, Jose Nino Unfiltered, that also has a podcast, El Nino Speaks. And yeah, that's what I do these days.
Awesome, man. Yeah, so I got connected to Jose because I saw a tweet that linked to a Substack, which you're not supposed to do because apparently X hates Substack. But it was from Scott Horton, who I'm a big fan of. And I just recently moderated a debate with Scott Horton on Zero Hedge. Had a great time. And his stuff has been popping off in my feed a lot lately. And it was to your Substack. When I read it, and I was like, this is one of the most compelling cases I've seen about this Minnesota deployment of ICE, giving more context and more of a sense of perspective than I've seen anywhere else. So compliments to you on that, man. I wanted to give you a quick quote from the very end just to give people a sense of what's in it, but we'll have the link below. So if you haven't read it, go check it out and go make sure to subscribe to Jose's Substack. It's a quote, "Trump's Immigration Act closes with two dead Americans and zero progress on credibly pushing back against mass migration. In sum, Trump's bombastic rhetoric and enforcement pageantry earn social media applause, inflame the left, fracture the nation, and preserve unchecked legal and illegal mass migration, precisely as the Great Replacement's architects intended." Man, that's hot, man. That's something else. Yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah. So I tried to bring some nuance in this discussion because I felt that both sides of the aisle just engage in a poo-flinging type of contest. First up, like the anti-ICE stuff, I've never been a fan of. I mean, my whole thing has been a very Buchananite type of immigration restriction type of policy where I believe that there needs to be like a multi-decade moratorium and that both legal and illegal immigration need to be restricted. But also at the same time, I felt the Trump administration is a bit schizophrenic on the way it implements its immigration agenda. And sometimes it actually does good things, but other times it just bungles in. A lot of this too isn't just confined to Trump. The problem is mostly the Republican Party in general. And this comes back to my experience working within the GOP, that the reason why Trump is kind of compelled to do all this like theatrics with ICE and all do these really fantastic raids is that they actually can't get enough votes in Congress to implement credible reforms, long-lasting reforms, because there's just too many pro-mass migration Inc. Republicans that just kills any legislation on the spot. And this is one thing I try to tell people, that we're having systemic issues with regards to immigration reform and all of that, and that there has to be like a thorough clearing out of the political class. And unfortunately, if you fall into the polarization vortex of either being like anti-ICE or being a just blind cheerleader for the administration, nothing's going to get done ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, the political theater thesis, I think, is super interesting because it kind of checks. And there's a lot of people across the spectrum are now kind of seeing it that way. I think the way that the Fox News and Con Inc. is covering it is as this Minnesota deployment is a response to the Somali fraud situation. Is that your read as well?
Well, yeah. And here's where it's really schizophrenic, too. There's definitely as well of kind of like owning the libs, because there's a really, in the Trump era, I've noticed with a lot of conservatives that, and this is part and parcel of the movement, that it's not about legislating. It's all about creating content and just getting clicks and all of that. And with the Somali welfare fraud, there is a very valid case and a very uncomfortable discussion about legal migration, because those Somalis, they're all legal migrants that have been resettled by a combination of Christian and Jewish resettlement nonprofits over the decades to Minnesota and other states like Maine as well. And that's part of a strategy of tension that the so-called great replacement elites want to create, where they bring people from war-torn areas that have very alien cultures, and they put them in homogenous states that have pretty generous welfare states like Minnesota. I mean, Minnesota is basically like Scandinavia on U.S. soil. Mm-hmm. And it coincidentally has very similar issues to what you see in Sweden over the last decade. And the thing is, it's ultimately a legal migration question. And I mean, I'm all in favor of denaturalizing a lot of these people, remigration and all of that, but they brought in ICE for that. And ICE is mostly for dealing with illegals. And when you look at Minnesota, its illegal population is pretty middling. I've seen numbers ranging from like 150,000 to 300,000. And I mean, yeah, all those people should be deported. I fully support that 100%. But I feel that they brought in this whole like massive force there as just like to go after very few migrants. And it's very incoherent too, because people don't know, are you going after Somalis? Are you going after criminal illegal aliens? Are you going after just illegal aliens in general? And what I was kind of pointing out in this article, and I wanted to make, is that if you want to just go to Minnesota, go and get easy points, go after like big corporations or some of these small to medium sized businesses that employ illegals, and you can get that done pretty easily. But by creating this whole spectacle where the rationale for the deployment of ICE units there changes by the minute, it makes your immigration enforcement causes, it discredits it ultimately. And it's just turned into a total dumpster fire. And I mean, also there's also, I think too, there's also the kind of like slop tier Tim Walz like versus like Republican type of fight that many in the conservative media want. Whereas I would say that a real fight that should be happening is the administration versus Jacob Fry, the mayor there, that is actually like very open about turning the city into a sanctuary city. This is a guy, he is a certified radical that stoked the flames of like racial tensions during BLM. He is a big booster of sanctuary policies and mass migration, and he is a Zionist radical that clamped down on pro-Palestinian demonstrations. So this guy is an invade the world and bite the world type, but yeah, there's not as much focus on him. Whereas it's easy to get into it's much easier to frame this thing as a partisan, like red state versus blue state thing. I've been saying this for a while, that immigration enforcement has to be done across the board. Like nobody should be like free from it, whether it's in a swing state like here in North Carolina, which has massive agricultural capture and tons of Republican connected chicken plants and all of that, or in like the deep South as well. And then also blue states like New Jersey and all of that. But by turning this into like a red versus blue thing, we really dumb down the discourse and of mass migration, which is a national phenomenon. No state is exempt from this. And by doing this, Republicans really set themselves back. And honestly, it's more of a feature, not a bug, because the Republican Party is still largely owned by a combination of big business and a lot of these small to medium-sized businesses that rely on cheap labor, whether it's illegal or legal.
So, and I kind of had the impression that, you know, chasing the headline as being a big part of this, like trying to get a favorable media cycle by seeming to fight it. And I think that's actually a feature of what they're looking for in the Trump versus Walz dynamic, where there's a highly well-known Democrat. And this is me with my election campaign manager hat on, right? Like, how to position Republicans best for next year. Well, we start the fight early and we show that we're fighting the left to excite the Republican base. But I just don't know if that ever, like, really became the narrative, right? It kind of failed to become the narrative, more so than like these shootings became the narrative, or that the effort, I mean, for example, I didn't even know, and I like pay attention, but this deployment of 3,000 ICE agents from outside the state into the state at a particular juncture didn't even have its own media cycle. Like, that should have been bigger if you want to set up this, we're solving the Minnesota problem, kind of story. And it just never really took off.
Yeah, that's the thing too. When you treat immigration enforcement like a media spectacle or a media op, is that in an ideal world, the deportation of people is something you'll hear about like in the news in passing. It's not like some like wall-to-wall social media coverage where people are posting about it on TikTok or whatever, and all of that. I mean, people will obviously film stuff on their own volition, but the whole content as public policy type of angle the Republican Party is pushing, I think it's not very good. And it also just really changes the perception of what you're trying to do. Like, in an ideal world, mass deportations and all of that is something that you would happen. You won't really see like the how the sausage is made. You wouldn't really see it. I mean, we've already seen it in the 1950s. Heck, even in the late 20s with Herbert Hoover and then Eisenhower with Operation Wetback, where they deported well over like 2 million illegal aliens. And it didn't have like wall-to-wall coverage and have like this constant like social media frenzy. But the problem is that when you turn these type of actions into a show, it will get very clownish quickly. I mean, if they were going to send like 3,000 of those people to go after every like business that was doing all this, that'd be great. But back to your point about the Somali thing, this goes back to Congress. If you want to talk about this fraud, clamp down on that, and eventually denaturalize Somalis, you have to pass laws. And the problem is, the Republican Party is not designed to govern. And if you look at how polarized Congress is, for the first, I was looking at the stat the other day, the first time in like U.S. history, this is like the third congressional term where the House majority is within single digits. So hardly anything can actually get passed. There's a lot of gridlock. Mm-hmm. And I read somewhere that in 2023, only like, I think 27 laws were passed. And in 1990, I think about 400 something laws were passed. So effectively, Congress is just becoming dysfunctional in general. It can't even govern, do like basic stuff. And with regards to immigration, we can talk about like bad laws as far as economics, but for the issue of immigration, that's ultimately a state policy where you want like a state that's competent enough to where we have like people that can pass like laws like immigration moratoriums, E-verified, all that. Mm-hmm. You want to have that in this context. And because the Congress is so dysfunctional, you can't do that. So in turn, the Trump administration and a lot of Republicans will go ad hoc and do these type of performative measures. And it just creates this an additional set of problems too. So
one of the other problems is just that any of the things that Trump's accomplishing could just be unrolled by the next administration unless you put it in a code, right? Unless you're all these executive orders, EOs, are going to just be turned over in 2028 if we don't actually pass something. Part of that, at least two of the assessments, I'd like to know what you think about this. So when it comes to the reading Congress, you know, each part of the bicameral legislature different, the House seems to have more of a moderate versus conservative problem. There's about 30 moderates that really prevent a lot of the worst stuff and enable the worst stuff. For example, yes, this most recent car shutoff legislation. Almost all the Republican states have passed something saying they don't want that in their state. Yet it still passes with like 30 or 40 Republicans voting for it. And in the Senate, it seems that the filibuster is the larger problem, specifically the zombie filibuster, which it's interesting to see folks like Mike Lee, who's an originalist and a very traditionalist Republican, more conservative than your average bird there, basically come out and say he wants to end the zombie filibuster because it's just you just can't get anything done. And we have too many things that are subject to a filibuster rule.
What's the difference between a filibuster and a zombie filibuster?
Yeah, so a filibuster is where I literally get up and talk for as long as I want to, Yeah. Right. And so when you think of that, think of when the rules apply in some circumstances, that's the rule. So when Rand Paul got up way back in the day after the NDAA passed that said that you could effectively extraditionally kill Americans, he got up and spoke for like 28 hours or something like that. Yeah. And it caused a whole media cycle, that kind of stuff. But they still ended up passing the damn thing, right?
Yeah.
That was because of that. The zombie filibuster couldn't apply. It is more about how you can't actually bring anything to the Senate floor if you don't have already pre-signed 60 votes. That's the zombie filibuster. That pretty much prevents any vote from coming to the floor to be tested. And you can just filibuster basically just by having the minority party say, you don't have the votes, because we do.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yeah. This goes back to my days when I used to lobby for National Association of Gun Rights. And on issues like immigration restriction or Second Amendment, I've covered like journalistically and I've done whip counts of people who you can absolutely guarantee will scuttle any pro-immigration restriction and pro-gun measures. And there's actually a lot of overlap with that. There's at least 10 to 15 people. Like, they are like people like Maria Elvira Salazar, Mario Diaz-Balart, and Brian Fitzpatrick, those people. You can always count on those people to just scuttle this. That's why I've said this before to many people who were saying, oh, immigration restriction is around the corner, like last year. I'm like, not so fast. Because there, I can, on any given vote, I can just predict it, that it's not going to even come to a vote because there's at least 10 to 20 people in the House that will vote against it. And in the Senate, you'll have like that same problem too with the whole filibuster issue. And this is a sign of like dysfunction, because if you can't pass basic laws that advance like the public good in certain contexts or repeal bad laws, what's the point? And this is really bad too, because it increases more power in not just like the executive orders, but also the bureaucracy, the permanent state too. And because now, like, what's the point of having representatives if you can't govern, you can't pass legislation, hold people accountable for legislation? Because that's the thing too. The whole point of representative governance is that people need to be put on the record, public roll call votes. They need to be put on the record to where they stand on heated issues. That's the whole point of being an elected official, that you're supposed to serve the public and be scrutinized by it. By engaging in these shenanigans, these backroom deals where controversial legislation X is just tabled because like there are like 20, 30 Republicans that killed it behind the scenes through weird committee stuff. That stuff is just, it's oligarchical stuff, because ultimately these people, they have to be held to account for their behavior, and it provides them political cover. Many people, to be honest, in the Republican Party, and I've talked to immigration restrictionists over the years who say like nobody in DC really cares about reforming immigration both sides of the aisle because of the fact of how bought off these people are by the Chamber of Commerce and a lot of other corporate interests and just Mass Migration Inc. And as a result of that, it's a lot of hooting and hollering, but when the rubber meets the road, nobody's going to go to that public roll call vote. And that is a feature, not a bug.
So one of the questions I could see kind of rising in the audience mind at this point is like, well, what does it matter? I mean, I saw the Wall Street Journal and New York Times and a bunch of places reported that Trump is pivoting away from Minnesota at this point, and he's going to put a new leadership in charge. It's going to be Homan, right? Am I got that name right? Homan. And the border czar is now going to be in charge of this particular area of ICE or that state specifically, and work with the governor, and that there's some call that happens between Trump and Walz. So while the Trump administration themselves says, we're not pivoting, we're still all in on Minnesota, et cetera, et cetera. So which is it? How are you reading the current moment? Since your article came out, this might be a pivot from the administration, or this is just mainstream media, you know, spin on what's happening?
Yeah, I haven't really followed up as much, because I do look at more things from like a bigger picture. I think they're eventually going to pivot to other states, especially as the midterms start coming up, because I think it's in Trump's interest to break polarization and start going after also red states as well that have a lot of illegal aliens too, especially in the agricultural and just like food processing industries. I think that's probably the best course of action, and also like purple states too, to go there, and that will like end like the bad optics there. I think it's a good way to do that, because the like I've said before, the immigration issue should not be a red versus blue thing. I mean, there was once a time when Democrats actually supported this stuff on labor grounds, on labor union grounds, but unfortunately things have gotten so polarized now that everybody just doesn't look at these things rationally.
Incredibly, have you seen the reporting from James O'Keefe on this? He exposed that the SEIU was in part behind the organizational capability to confront ICE in Minneapolis, right? Union is behind anti-labor enforcement, like illegal labor enforcement. That is such
a joke.
If you would consider it from, if this was 50 years ago, you'd be like, what are you talking about? That can't be true.
Yeah. Organized labor in the United States has turned into a joke because a lot of these organizations have been like salted by cultural radicals and other kind of open borders boosters that effectively just become another vector for mass migration. Used to be like the AFL-CIO was actually a strong check against this, against mass migration historically. This is a trend, actually, not just in the U.S., but also across the West. Heck, even communist parties in, like, European politics all, like, were against mass migration on labor restriction grounds. But things have changed in the last 50 years because of how culturally radical and also just brainwashed people have become because of corporate media. And the general capture of institutions by these people that make like mass migration look like it's like a holy sacrament or like a very normal part of the economy and the broader society. But yeah, the SEIU, that has not shocked me in the slightest now, because many of these orgs, they actually just become like woke guilds where the only thing they really regulate is if you say like mean things like in the workplace or like say something out of pocket that's politically incorrect and stuff like that. But like it's gone from the original mission of actually like checking corporate power to just policing people's behavior that so that it conforms on these like culturally like liberal like leftist grounds.
Well, let me tell you why I think this is a real pivot away is because I see at least the statements by the administration getting so out of hand, specifically on the Second Amendment stuff, things getting so like toxic for his own base. This might be maybe being too online, but I can only assume that between the shootings and the Second Amendment thing and the fracturing of support on these things, he really needs a different narrative. And so if this is all in pursuit of a particular narrative for the midterms, he can't let this continue at this pace. So he's got to redeploy one of those 3,000 someplace else. He might do so to a red state. Interesting in your article, what you say is analysis from the Cato Institute found that 95% of non-citizen population growth between 2019 and 2023 went to red states, which, like you say, that's very unintuitive. He can get much better compliance from governors in red states where they can actually get those numbers up, right? Because they can actually go to the jails and get those people out of jails much easier, the way Obama apparently did when he had big deportation numbers, and therefore actually have like a statistical win on something, even if it's less than maybe Obama. Maybe he can get like something that he can actually be proud of and like run on in the next cycle.
Yeah, that's like the easier thing, or like any type of purple state as well. They could easily do that. But the issue is ultimately that I've argued this, that the Republican Party and both the Democratic parties are structurally incapable of doing this stuff for different reasons. Democrats, I mean, their whole thing is they want to just turn the country into a Tower of Babel, especially their donor class. They want to turn it into this like multiracial Tower of Babel. And then Republicans, they generally want cheap labor and also just concentrate as much power in capital in general. And because of that, they're like Trump can perform certain deportations and form rational policies, but there's a limit. Because what I've noticed in the years of covering immigration is that once they start kind of hitting like a threshold of like deportations in these red states, the business community there, big, small, medium, it starts to get kind of antsy about this stuff. And that's the issue with the U.S. is that the system is too ossified and captured by oligarchical and just parasitic interests in general. And that prevents a lot of rational governance, in my opinion.
Well, it seems to me that at minimum, it's a good strategic advice, right? At minimum, if you say, Trump, we need to win the midterms. We need to go to Texas and Florida, which are two of the states that you cite, which is compelling numbers. I mean, you said earlier, you know, a couple hundred thousand in Minnesota. That sounds like a lot of people, right? But when you say that Texas has how many, 3 million or something like that, that are somewhat.
Yeah. 2 to 3 million. And that might be a conservative estimate, too, because, I mean, the illegal population, that's another thing, too. And this is the problem of the broken system of governance. We're not really getting the full picture in terms of how big these populations are in the U.S. And that's one thing, too, why. As well, the GOP and just the general political system doesn't have the stomach to do it because there's a lot. I mean, I've seen you see like the numbers, like the official numbers, like Pew, like even adjusted it to like 14 to 15 million total illegal aliens in the US. But I've seen some Harvard and Yale studies that point to like actually even close to like 25 million, 15. The 25 million. I mean, it's big, but it's what happens when you let this problem like kick the can down the road for so long. But it's got to be done.
Yeah. So hey, could this one of the thing I think about like the core cause of Minnesota, and that is like a disaster. Is it a disaster enough if it just got the public's attention off the Epstein files for a minute? Right, we're not talking about it anymore. It's gone. Right.
Yeah.
If the real op, and I'm trying to steel man what I'm seeing your position is, but I'm very sympathetic to it. If the real op was to do something to get, you know, to look like a populist and look like you're fighting the Democrats, and it has the tertiary benefit of getting the public's attention off the Epstein files for a minute, this is all win. Even with the bad coverage or the shootings and stuff like that, you're now in a much better position for the midterms.
Yes. I think Trump is a showman, so he knows that you have to have like constant movement, and he's really good at being able to not only capture attention, but moving on from like one front like story to another. And the Epstein thing, that's an anchor. And it's one of those things that's always biting him in the rear. And it really divides his base, and it starts to get people also wondering about like the just absolute rot of the system, because I've covered the whole mega group and Epstein thing, and it's when you look at it, it's potentially regime ending stuff, because if these type of clandestine networks are really what determine like the foreign policy and immigration policy, because most of these people here as well is I often say it's all one thing. They're part of the invade the world, invite the world type of neoconservative, neoliberal interventionist set that runs foreign policy and domestic policy and whatnot. And yes, I actually think that Trump is always like looking for a new thing right now, regardless of like optics or if it has like strategic gain, to get away from the Epstein stuff, because that's just not like good at all. It's actually created a bipartisan coalition that really threatens the ruling class, from Thomas Massie to Ro Khanna as well. And yeah, I mean, the Epstein stuff is going to always loom in the background too, because there is credible speculation to say that Trump as well could be blackmailed to an extent, and he has to make certain actions too, especially in like the Middle East or whatever, because of that. I mean, when you look at, I've written several articles where demonstrating and subsect the Judeo accelerationist presidency to talk about Trump. And then another one about the Trump family's deep relationship with just organized Zionism that goes back decades. There are, the Epstein stuff makes people not only skeptical about his ties with Epstein, but it also opens up a whole Pandora's box where you start to realize that the Trump family has very shady ties to some of the worst grug tier elements of Zionism in the United States. And Trump wants people to not look into that.
Hmm. Interesting. So, and if the whole theory is that this is that, and this is looking back at another article you wrote at the very end of last year, in December 2025, saying, you know, Trump's really, his record is actually being a fake populist, right? Of saying populist things, then doing pretty much basic Republican stuff. This seems to play into that, right? Is that there is, you want to keep the populace interested and distracted in things that aren't important so that you can then pursue your foreign policy goals, a little bit of domestic goals when it benefits the money interests, but not really interested in the whole welfare of the country. But is there any, but, and I think that's a, there's a case to be made there, but I just want to push you on this. Is there anything he's done that's been truly populist that you can think of that actually doesn't, that might go against that particular a narrative since he's come into office?
Yes, actually. And this is one thing it's funny. He doesn't tout it. The best immigration policy Trump pursued was the immigration moratorium during COVID. That was the only silver lining was the moratorium that he implemented, where they would just like to turn back everybody at the border. And Joe Biden maintained that too, with those Title 42 expulsions. And for the first time in a really long time, COVID was awful, like the lockdowns and all the mask stuff. But for the only silver lining of that time, because of the fact that migration just pretty much fell to zero, you did see in certain sectors of the economy actually have a tight labor force. And funny, and had Trump been reelected, I would have hoped that he would have maintained that moratorium.
What you're talking about here specifically is a moratorium on legal immigration.
Yeah, legal and illegal.
Illegal. Yeah.
That was his best policy objectively. But he rarely campaigns on that. He rarely talks about that now. And the Republican Party doesn't really talk about that as well as like a win for him. The border closure right now is also, but there's a caveat. Trump just doubled down on what Joe Biden did in late 2024, because for cynical reasons, after the huge mass migration surge rush that Biden facilitated in his presidency in like July 2024, it was like in the summer there, he started to get into negotiations with the Mexican government, start clamping down on migration. He did that for cynical electoral reasons, because like, he was getting dragged at the polls, and Trump really just doubled down on those policies that Biden implemented. And Trump does kind of boast about that every now and then, but he really doesn't really talk about it as much though these days, because he just goes on to like another issue. But no, in general, the thing about Trump is that when you remove the spectacle, the bells and whistles, his administration is a typical conservative administration. It's actually highly successful on conservative grounds, from the tax cuts to the remaking of the judiciary. It's very successful. But from a populist perspective, whether it's comes to like tackling high finance, thoroughly restricting immigration, or bringing about like a very coherent industrial policy, it leaves a lot to be desired. But that's really a problem with with just the system, because Republicans like in the House and the Senate, they're just not really down with populism, to be honest.
And a couple of the things I was thinking of to try to steel man the opposite side here, just best represent what I think might make people hesitate to that particular theory, is MAHA perhaps. Because I don't, having worked in D.C., having been around a lot of that stuff, I don't see how like banning food dyes, redoing the food pyramid, the childhood vaccines, Tylenol recommendations, stuff like that. I don't see how that seems to be a clear win in the populist direction. Now, that might be majoring in the minors from a more economic nationalist point of view. I could totally see that. But it is a populist movement that doesn't have a lot of corporate interests, money behind it. Is that fair to say?
I'm not as well versed about the whole MAHA movement, but yeah, I think you put it correctly that it is like majoring in the minors, because populism really deals with more the high finance, mass migration, and also foreign policy too, like the holy sacraments of the post-World War II order. And the Mahasov are interesting victories. I do think, for example, a lot of dieting standards and all of that has been heavily politicized over the years, and basic like low-carb diets and stuff have been demonized too by the powers that be, despite having decent benefits. I've followed low-carb dieting and paleo dieting for like close to 15 years now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that stuff is, it is like a, in the win column for Trump, are objectively good policies and should be praised. But when it comes to the actual like populist issues, the administration has left a lot to be desired. Sure. But it is interesting though that people are beginning to question certain lifestyle things that have been taken as like for granted over the years, or have just been treated as truth when actually the real information and investigations prove otherwise, especially with regards to carb consumption, meat consumption, and all of that. I think that there are some good conversations being had because of people like RFK Jr., but that's not something I really specialize in. But I would say that is one of the silver linings of Trump 2.0. In its favor.
Mm-hmm. So, I think this is an interesting contrast too. And I'm, you know, obviously no one's just their category, right? No one is just the thing, the box they put themselves in. So everything's a little more complicated, but I do think there's an interesting discourse to be had, especially in contrasting kind of your, what you're talking about when it comes to invade the world, invite the world. There's like a vision there of a populist nationalism that says like, we are a people and a thing, and we're actually separate from the world, and we're going to relate to a world a very specific way, to be a regular country in a regular time and not be, you know, inviting the world in as we bomb it. And then I do think like there's some other allies in this very pro restrictionist space on immigration that have a very different view. Recently, Nick Fuentes, for example, has really come out and become, well, as long as it's not in Israel's benefit, I'm very in favor of intervention, invading the world and Venezuela and these things. So I wanted your thoughts on, you know, how do you map that from your perspective of where it seems to be a contradiction there in Fuentes's point of view, at least, and these other kind of Cernovich and a whole bunch of those other pro-restrictionists who really got very soft all of a sudden once Venezuela happened on the question of invading the world.
Yeah, the issue of Venezuela, the problem is that they're using like the whole Monroe Doctrine argument, and I've written about this too in on Substack, that the problem with Venezuela is that the U.S. is still an empire that's very much everywhere, not just Latin America, but Africa, Europe, Asia, you name it. And because of that, talking about the Monroe Doctrine is out of place, due to the fact that the Monroe Doctrine, when it was originally conceived, presupposed that the United States was largely going to stay out of European affairs and just general affairs. It would just have like its own sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere and not allow for like extra hemispheric actors to establish like a military presence or form like a military alliance in the region. The issue of Venezuela, though, first off, the U.S. treats the whole globe as its sphere of influence now. Mm-hmm. And second of all, there's no evidence that there's any extra hemispheric actors establishing a military presence there. China's not doing it. Russia's not doing it. Iran's not doing it. They have obviously trade. Like, Russia does sell weapons to Venezuela, but it's defensive stuff. Mm-hmm. So that whole argument kind of falls apart. And a lot of these people think that we're able to go back to like a 19th century America where you have this restraint. But the problem is, that has long passed. We just have a really different ruling class. One that's really fanatic, the like Zionist, and honestly, Judeo-accelerationist at this point. And for example, even the Venezuela case too does have a slight Israeli angle to it, because there is a concerted effort by, especially with the Isaac Accords that Javier Milei has rolled out in Argentina. Mm. There is a concerted effort by U.S. foreign policy people, because it just now, it's not about making the world safe for democracy. It's not making the world safe for Zionist interests to cultivate a series of pro Israel governments in Latin America. So a lot of these issues are intersecting. But the right. problem with the Venezuela thing, though, I think with the U.S. was kind of like looking for a win. And they're kind of channeling like a 1980s, like we're going to have like a really quick victory, like in Grenada or Panama, and use like really jacked special forces guys to go in, just sweep Maduro and just get back on the win column. And that's what they're really doing, because if you listen to people like Elliot Abrams or like neocons like that and John Bolton, they were saying like this is a good way to get rid of like the Iraq War syndrome, like the way Reagan said we got rid of the Vietnam War syndrome. But this stuff, in my opinion, actually doesn't really uphold the national interest whatsoever. It, like, the issue with Venezuela, it really, as long as they're not hosting external actors, like, militarily, I think it should just have, like, normal trade relations. And, yeah, you could use, like, tariffs here and there, especially with migration issues. But other migration issues to, from Venezuela to the United States are the product of the sanctions that Trump pursued the maximum pressure in his first term. So, yeah, I just think that the Venezuela thing, I mean, I'm from there originally, and I have covered it casually over the years, but I think a lot of people don't really get what's going on there. And it's another of these like really performative things. Because here's another thing too, the Chavista regime is still intact there despite them snatching Maduro.
Yeah, so that's another great example of kind of zooming out for a minute and just kind of looking at it from the strategic messaging, the impression it's leaving with the American public. And I don't know, maybe because I'm too involved, I see it this way, but it seemed like the messaging was confused. It never really landed. It's the drug boats. Oh, it's Hamas, or they're selling selling drugs to Al-Qaeda that's moving it to Europe. I mean, like, and then we're like, but I thought the drugs were about America. Like, what happened here? There's so much confusion that it never really landed about exactly why we were doing what we were doing. And then it was done, and it was like, oh, well, this is actually all geostrategy. It's actually about China and keeping 5% of oil from getting to China that they can't suddenly just get from Indonesia or Iran or Russia or all these other oil-producing things that are closer to them. I don't understand what this is.
Oh, yeah, it's so confusing. Yeah, actually, with the 5% thing, if you look at Chinese customs data, it's actually only like 2% of their oil imports come from Venezuela. Like, it's so...
Crazy.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. Actually, yeah, the rationale is so, well, on the drug stuff, that is so farcical because, one, for example, the guy who Trump recently pardoned, the ex-president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, is actually a certified cocaine trafficker who was arrested for cocaine trafficking. And there's a reason, and the reason why Trump did so, this guy is actually a straight-up Israeli asset, Juan Orlando Hernandez, the guy who pardoned, who was cultivated by this program called the Mashav, by an Israeli program that's a kind of like outreach and humanitarian thing promoted by the Israeli state in the developing world, especially in countries that have a really growing evangelical populations like Guatemala, Honduras, and even like Nigeria, Kenya, and like in Africa. And this guy, he basically just turned into a made man, because in D.C. These days in Latin America, if you're a pro-Zionist politician, you get a pass. You get a hall pass to do crazy stuff. For example, Ecuador, they have a president, Daniel Noboa, literally born in Miami. And his family has been implicated in using like a banana business to traffic cocaine. And this guy, no military action has been taken against him. And he's also got that hall pass too, because he's in that Zionist power configuration where he's bowed down to the Sanhedrin there. And that's the thing too in Latin America with this rationale for the drug stuff was as farcical with Venezuela. It's not even a big player. It's funny enough, it's most of its drug trade. Venezuela's drug trade, you know, just goes to like Europe. But then like, yeah, the Hamas and Hezbollah thing, that's just like another ploy of creating a WMD narrative to get a lot of the Israel first Jewish supremacist set to get on board of a conflict with Venezuela. Venezuela does have strong ties with Iran and even Hezbollah, but like it's very defensive in nature for what they do. They're not like sending some like like they're not creating some intricate like launch pad network that's about to like attack like the US, like right. these people. They have this very cartoon Hollywood type set where they're paint this image that Venezuela is courting this wave of like terror networks that are just seconds away of being activated across like the Western Hemisphere. It's this bunch of headcanon. It's really like neoconservative headcanon that they've mm-hmm. imbibed.
Yeah, I think headcanon is exactly the right word. And a lot of this is we don't have like a good as a country, like just zooming out even further as a country, we don't have a good idea of the status quo. And it touches all these things in very interesting ways. I mean, you look at like immigration. It seems to me like your average restrictionist talking about the motives or trying to post hoc rework the motives of the Trump administration at any given time has just completely missed that he's decided not to really enforce immigration on hotels and agriculture and a lot of the businesses that you mentioned that are so important to red states. And that just seems to be missing from like their broader support of the Minnesota operation and everything else, that there's no like sense of status quo. And on foreign policy, same thing. Like we're talking about the Monroe Doctrine so that we can stop Venezuela drugs from going to Europe. And you're like, you know, all these things just kind of become incoherent and lack any kind of, and part of that is because like your average person just isn't really understanding where we're actually sitting at, or that, you know, what the actions of the status quo are that Trump's either violating or reinforcing, because it's all kind of vague and ill-defined amongst the general public. Just some thoughts there. You got anything? Sorry.
Yeah. One of a guest on my show by the name of Joseph Jordan said it best, that Trump is a performer, not a reformer. So what's happening here is that a lot of the performative stuff is done to kind of mask what really the Trump administration is. It's the Judeo-accelerationist presidency, because when you look at the most coherent policies he's implemented, it has been like breaking taboos with regards to the U.S.-Israel relationship and doing everything possible to pursue maximalist aims in regards to Israel's interests. He's actually, for example, the embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is something that not even Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush did. Also, the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights is something the foreign policy class, whether it's like previous neoconservatives or Democrats, never touched. And then the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and then the bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities. Bush was even gun shy about pursuing direct hawkish action against Iran in that respect. And what I try to tell people is that when you peel back the onion, he, in many respects, when you look at Trump's connections over the decades from his mentor, Roy Cohn, who was very connected to the Jewish criminal underworld and a lot of the Zionist networks, and many of the connections Trump has forged over the years with elements of organized Zionism and organized Jewry. He is at really deep ties to the so-called Israel lobby that even neocons and neoliberals in both parties never had. And my working theory has been that that's what he was brought in here to do, to carry out this agenda in a way that other Republicans could not do. And that's why I think that the populist project is largely smoke and mirrors. And this is not confined to the United States either. In a lot of European countries, a lot of the populist movements, I have argued, are stalking horses for Zionism. I call it Zio-populism, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of both Jewish and Gentile donors that are Zionists that prop up these movements. And they use populist rhetoric and aesthetics and promise all stuff. But when they're in office and you peel back the onion and look at the record, what they basically just advance is just measures that make the world safe for Zionism.
Interesting. All right. Well, I know we're coming up on our time limit. So thank you so much, Jose. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, you can find me on Substack, josealnino.org. And that's Jose Nino Unfiltered. And that's also where my podcast El Nino Speaks is at. And that is also on YouTube, Spotify, and iTunes. And yeah, and I'm also writing at Headline USA as the deputy editor there, and I'm a weekly contributor to the Libertarian Institute as well.
Awesome. So yeah, and if you're checking us out anywhere else, obviously go to humanreactionpod.com. Check out all the stuff we got there. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, all the major sources for podcasts and media. And everybody stay salty. Have a great week. Stay safe out there. Thanks for watching.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.